From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Word out today from the Princeton Review's 2004 survey of best colleges in America, the toughest college to get into in the country is the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. In 1998, in a bid to bridge a growing culture gap with mainstream America, West Point threw open its doors to Rolling Stone contributing editor David Lipsky. Lipsky stayed for 4 years. What he found was and was not the West Point of Douglas MacArthur, Dwight Eisenhower, Ulysses S. Grant, and Stonewall Jackson. West Point is changing. In a moment, in an archive edition of On Point, Life on the Long Gray Line, the inside story of West Point now, and the new education of America's Army elite. But first, terrorism by the numbers. The London-based World Markets Research Center has rated 186 countries in order of their risk for a 9/11-style terrorist attack in the next year. Colombia tops the list with Israel and Pakistan rounding out the top three. The United States is fourth and considered highly likely to see a terrorist attack. David Rice is a senior research analyst for the World Market Research Center and co-author of the Terrorism Index. I asked him how they went about determining a country's risk of terrorist attack.
We use a five-factor model, and if that makes sense, what I can do is walk through that because I think it'll go a long way to explain how the U.S. ranks and why it's ranked fourth.
Sure. What are the factors you take into account?
We look at motivation, which we weight at 40%, and motivation speaks to just how motivated a particular terrorist group or terrorist is in carrying out such an attack. Presence speaks to the proximity of a terrorist group. What sphere of influence are they operating in?
Are they in or near the country, the target?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Third criterion is scale. What scale of an attack are we looking at? Is it a small car bomb? Does it entail mailing some white powder, anthrax, to an individual?
In other words, if they attacked, what kind of scale might be reasonably expected?
Exactly. Fourth is efficacy. How good are they? How well trained? How well financed? What is their likelihood of carrying out such an attack?
So some countries might have terrorists targeting them that are kind of bumbling or amateurish. Others may have the real pros.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the final is prevention, which speaks to how prepared is a government or an intelligence agency or a police or military service to intercept, interdict, or prevent such an attack from occurring.
So take us down through the U.S. profile, then, by these criteria. Motivation is 40% of your weighting. How high did you rate the motivation of terrorists who might target the United States?
We gave it a 10 out of 10. Ooh. Motivation is extremely important, especially in this case. And the example I want to give you briefly is you look at the West Bank. The Israeli army has checkpoints. They have the military set up there, but it seems as though that Hamas or whatever other group can infiltrate those levels of security at their leisure. And what that means is if you have a highly motivated terrorist, virtually almost no level of prevention is going to keep them from achieving their goal if they're willing to go the distance to carry out that attack.
So on the motivation front, the situation for the U.S. really couldn't be worse. You're saying they are thoroughly motivated.
Absolutely.
All right. Presence. Terrorists in the country.
I would say that that is an absolute certainty. As has already been shown, cells do exist in this country. They are able to operate under the radar, as the 9/11 terrorists did for years. They're able to be members of our communities. They're able to train and raise money within our border. So it's an absolute certainty that they're here among us.
In numbers, or do you pay attention to that?
Well, I would say in numbers, but also in terms of sophistication. The immigration policies in the United States pre-9/11 were fairly liberal and fairly porous in the sense that there was very little follow-up on visas that had expired or student visas that were no longer valid.
So is that another 10 for 10 for the U.S.?
No, in terms of presence, it's a 5. And the reason for that is because when you compare it to other regions, specifically Southeast Asia, where you have Jamaat Islamiyah, which operates with much greater freedom, and there are just many more of them. Also with respect to the Middle East, where there are a number of countries where the governments tend to look the other way, which means it's more of a haven for them.
Mm-hmm. So scale of threat, how did the United States stack up?
Again, the United States ranks a 10. I mean, we're a big target, so you know, the bigger they are, the harder they fall, so to speak. So we do rank a 10 on that scale.
That is, if there were an attack on the United States, the odds are it could be a big one.
Absolutely. I can speak from experience because I was on Wall Street last Thursday when the power went out. Mm-hmm. And although this, by all accounts, was not the result of a terrorist act, it very well could have been. What has come to light as a result of the ensuing investigation is that it would have been fairly easy for a terrorist or a terrorist group to target certain critical points in our transmission network and take them down.
That was pretty obvious to everyone last week. Efficacy, that is the competence of terrorists targeting the U.S.
They rank a 9. And again, we are the prime target for the most part of al-Qaeda, which has proven to be the most sophisticated, the most well-financed, the most highly trained terrorist group that we know of. So we're likely to get the best of the best from the terrorist community.
And prevention, the capacity of the United States to prevent a potential attack?
2.5.
Low.
We're fairly low. With respect to our size, our openness, the motivation of the terrorists, we've done woefully little to actually prevent against a possible attack.
David Rice, you do these ratings essentially for large multinational corporations and banks who are your clients. I don't suppose it means that they won't do business here.
No, and that's not the intent. You know, and the intent of this is not to be alarmist. It's meant as a tool for awareness. There's a lot that governments and businesses can do to protect against possible terrorist attack, including what to do if there is a terrorist attack. I think what we saw with respect to New York, even though that wasn't terrorist, is that the region was unprepared to deal with the power outage. Although I myself was in New York and I saw that the people reacted fairly calmly and fairly well and emergency services responded as necessary, this wasn't a terrorist attack. I mean, if there was something on a larger scale, I think that most people feel that we're just not prepared for the next 9/11 if it were to occur.
David Rice, very quickly, just give us, on the sunny side, which were the least likely target nations in the world for terrorist attack?
Well, I don't know how sunny this is, but the least likely was North Korea.
Oh.
And the reason for that is because if you looked at an X and Y axis and you look at the level of openness of a country equals their level of vulnerability, switch that around, North Korea is the most closed society in the world, therefore the least vulnerable.
David Rice, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
David Rice is a senior research analyst for the World Market Research Center and co-author of the World Terrorism Index. He spoke with me from Boston. Of all the institutions in this country, said Teddy Roosevelt, none is more absolutely American. Roosevelt was talking about West Point, elite training ground for the U.S. Army's military leaders. Think Robert E. Lee, William Westmoreland, Norman Schwarzkopf, George Custer, George Patton, to name a few famed alums. In 1998, West Point made Rolling Stone contributing editor David Lipsky an unprecedented offer: be the first journalist ever given complete access to the Academy's cadets and staff. He followed a class of cadets from their arrival at the U.S. Military Academy until their graduation in 2002. What he found was a lot more than just West Point tradition. He found an academy coming to terms with women in its ranks, with changing career aspirations and central values, with the meaning of 9/11 for the U.S. military, with what it means to be a warrior in the 21st century. David Lipsky chronicles his journalistic tour of duty in the new book, Absolutely American. What lessons do you want drilled into America's West Point elite today? Do you envy the close-knit community of honor and duty, or is it all too much for you? Joining me now from New York is David Lipsky, contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine and author of the new book, Absolutely American, 4 Years at West Point. Good evening and welcome, David Lipsky.
Tom, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Thanks for joining us. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
David Lipsky, here you are, Rolling Stone man, rolling into West Point. Huh. You say in the preface you had written a lot about American college-age students at many institutions, universities around the country, several dozen, before you got to West Point, and that at West Point you found something, as I read you, something entirely different. What was that difference that you found?
Well, it was the big shock for me was that, you know, when you go around, I'd been to about 35 colleges before that, and from like University of Washington to Yale, right? So you can kind of run, and then like tiny colleges in between. And I assumed that when I got to West Point, what I would find is I didn't think that the cadets would have cable, but I thought that they would be reading about MTV Spring Break and just cursing up a storm because they couldn't go and they were stuck in uniform. But in fact, the cadets were happier, better adjusted, just having a better time than the cadets at the civilian colleges, and that kind of floored me.
We're going to hear a lot about West Point tonight in the detail there, but I just wanted to ask you right off the bat, what do you take away from that? I mean, are you suggesting that Americans would all be better off if they were slapped into uniform when they were 17, 18 years old? Or just that there's something about the rigor of that military academy setting that brings out something happy? We associate it with training warriors, not necessarily happiness.
Well, Tom, it could be something in the water. It could be very simple. You never neglect the nutritional type answer. But
4,000 calories a day, you described.
When I have 4,000 calories a day, Tom, I'm always in a good mood.
You're sated. Right.
I think that a lot of us, certainly one of the funny things for me was not just other college students, but certainly my friends. I was in my early 30s when I went up there the first time. You begin to wonder if your life matters, and you begin to wonder if you're too cut off from other people, if anyone really is looking out for you on a minute-by-minute basis. And you wonder if you should try your hardest or if that would be maybe too trying, right, if it would be exhausting. Mm. And then I went to this place, West Point, where people were trying their hardest all the time, where, in fact, if you kind of stumbled in any number of ways, and, of course, people at West Point stumble all the time, right? I mean, there's physical, hugely challenging physical stuff.
Like all of us and then some, because they have obstacle courses.
Exactly. And then not only do you know you're doing something that's really valuable for the country, but the people around you who are serious people who you know you should respect are telling you that you're doing something of value to the country. And I think it's actually great. You know what you're doing is meaningful. And I think those three basic things are what humans need. And I think that we forget that we need that at our peril.
You write about a culture gap that the U.S. military, you say, it was and is very concerned about, a gap between U.S. military culture and U.S. mainstream civilian culture. What's the nature of that gap?
Well, that gap was the reason that Rolling Stone generally and me specifically got invited up to West Point. At the end of World War II, you had about 14 million people had been in uniform. And then we fought this long Cold War where everyone was, you had all these war movies and people were thinking about the military all the time. It was always an issue in presidential elections as well. And so then right after the Cold War ended, about 1989, if it ended in the 1800s, we wouldn't have had all these problems.
Indeed.
At the end of the last century, right?
Yes. But
it ended and people began thinking, why do we need this big a military? Why do we have this big a military? And then, if you fast forward about 10 years, people were kind of saying, hey, do we have a military? And the way this kind of panned out and what made it clear to the two generals who won West Point is that they were driving with a group of other generals to an all-general conference, and they were wearing their Class B uniform, which is that green uniform with the fruit salad of medals. That's a term of art, by the way, fruit salad.
All right.
Fruit salad of medals. And they stopped at a Denny's, and the hostess saw them in uniform, smiled, and said, I want to thank all of you for the great work you do on behalf of the Parks Department.
The military was so far out of mind that she thought of them as park rangers, not as U.S. generals.
Exactly, and that made them, and that to them made quite clear they had to do something about bridging that culture gap, and that's why they reached out to us.
We're going to look into all that training and that culture and maybe the gap there. But, Jack, I want to turn to you. The military has certainly been front and center in many American minds lately. And here, David Lipsky's pulling back the covers on exactly what goes into training the leaders of at least one branch of the U.S. Army.
Yes, and let me just read the U.S. Military Academy mission statement. It says volumes about why this would be attractive for people and even something that would be conducive to their happiness. To educate, train, and inspire the Corps of Cadets so that each graduate is a commissioned leader of character, committed to the values of duty, honor, country, professional growth through a career as an officer in the U.S. Army, and a lifetime of selfless service to the nation. Well, in an age of increasing social Darwinism, where more and more Americans are isolated on our own without protection against the marketplace, and where even that is thought to be a bad thing, an impediment to the good society, here is another world indeed where selfless service, where comradeship, where solidarity, where all the virtues and values that are increasingly drained out of our competitive capitalist society are honored. Sounds pretty attractive.
Boy, Jack, I see you striding down to the enlistment office there, Jack. Watch
out. I got bad feet, and those 4,000 calories, I couldn't do it.
Keep a grip. David Lipsky, stand by. We're going to hear a lot more detail. We're talking tonight about the inside story of West Point and the education of America's Army elite. And what lessons do you want drilled into America's West Point military elite? Do you have a personal connection to West Point? Did you study there? Have you served under a West Pointer? What's the West Point hallmark? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the inside story of West Point today and the new education of America's Army elite. What lessons do you want drilled into America's West Point military leaders? Are you surprised that a Rolling Stone writer would fall in love with the West Point culture? We're joined tonight by David Lipsky. He's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and author of the new book, Absolutely American, 4 Years at West Point. We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. David Lipsky, people may have an image in mind of a West Point education, and in particular, maybe that first brutal year of hazing that for a long time at least was kind of one of the best public faces of West Point was all about. But you say West Point's gone through a big changes so big that they're collectively referred to as the changes. What was West Point? What is it in terms of the student experience? Is it still that kind of do or die obstacle course of physical and mental challenges?
It is. It's the same course, just without people yelling at you on all sides and making you run in place wearing a poncho in the shower room until you pass out from exhaustion.
So the new West Point, I was surprised by some of the things I'm reading here. People out on drill wondering what time Felicity is on television and whether they'll be back in time. Is the old kind of Spartan challenge and simplicity of life there a thing of the past, or is it still part of West Point education?
Tom, it's a great question. The idea, and it was kind of a carryover from the way that 19th century colleges, the first colleges in America, worked, that one reason that schools like Princeton are located in what seems to people now as the middle of nowhere is that college presidents back then felt that the only way to really train students was to take them away from the, quote, folly and dissipation of the modern city. West Point stuck to that, and the idea was that, and with West Point it was kind of more dire, you were trying to get 18-year-old kids to live at a much higher standard and to devote themselves to kind of more noble ideals. And the idea, really up until about 1997 or 96, was you had to remove them almost totally from the society they came from. So until about the year that I got there, no TVs in the dorms, no phones in the dorms, no computers with instant messages or anything like that. You were cut off from the culture that you'd come from. And there was an anxiety among the people who were running West Point that was great and you did bring them up to a higher standard. But when they went out to work with the Joes, to lead the Joes in the Army, and Joe is what you call an enlisted soldier in the Army. It mm-hmm. comes from G.I. Joe. Mm-hmm. That they couldn't make contact. They couldn't make contact with the lingua franca of America, which is pop culture.
That they would not know or relate to the troops that they were to lead.
No, exactly. So every time that there was a march and you heard a cadet saying, "Let's get back for Felicity," somewhere a general was smiling.
So what does it mean? Does it mean a softer West Point or one that simply keeps a tap root out in the mainstream culture even as it builds this internal culture?
No, it's still really hard. I mean, I'm laughing because the book is stories about people like four or five cadets to kind of focus on and their four-year experience going through. And anybody who thinks it's not hard because you can catch Felicity on the major networks, right, should go spend a week there or even a day there.
Who gets recruited for West Point? Who applies to West Point? How elite is the group there now?
Tom, I always thought of it as a high school all-star team. The way the system works is it's very similar to congressional representation. Every state has the same number of nominations to West Point as the number of congressional people they have in the House of Reps. So you get like 4.0 student body presidents and team captains at let's say Churchill High School in Maryland competing against the same person, the similar person from the neighboring high school, and they kind of do a do or die kind of cage match, and the best people from each region go on to West Point. You get about 50,000 people begin the process, and about 1,100, 1,200 show up on what's called R Day for the first day of training, the last day of June every year.
And when you look around the world today, David Lipsky, and see how the U.S. military is more and more, in many places, the face of the United States, maybe the foremost face, these are the leaders of one big branch of that military. What's the face that West Pointers show the world?
I think that they show maybe the best face that we could show the world, because they are both polite as hell, right? I mean, they're really fit, and they are doing something that's very different from what their peers are doing. They are giving the young part of their lives, and for some of them, they're giving their whole careers over to serving their country.
at the same time that most of their peers are talking about getting bigger apartments or cooler cars or hipper sound systems or iPods with more gigs.
Jack, as you read here, you know the military is being asked to do a lot more these days, more kinds of tasks in more places, and to take some pretty hard steering leadership right now from Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. How did you see, Jack, the West Pointers described in David's book fitting in to that world being shaped for them?
Well, I think they're going to have a lifetime of frustration. I think to be a member of the U.S. Officer Corps today is to be biting your lip all the time. I mean, the professional military advised Secretary Rumsfeld that they needed 100,000 more people in Iraq from day one, that they didn't have enough people there for force protection, let alone protecting the Iraqis and fighting a counterinsurgency campaign. And Rumsfeld has not budged from his commitment, from his idea that they're not needed. And so here you have, now why is he doing that? Well, is there some major strategic reason there? I don't think so. I think it's about his pride. So for Don Rumsfeld's pride, young men and women are today out on a limb in Iraq. Now, you're an officer. You know that. And every day you've got to suck that up. You've got to understand that you're working for people who are basically trying to cover their rear ends with your, possibly with your blood. That is a very tough thing for anyone to do.
David Lipsky, do you imagine current West Point grads looking at the world that way?
No, I know they do follow Army politics, but one of the great things about serving in the military is that you're there for the job, and whatever the politicians tell you the job is, you do. And the satisfactions come from meeting the standard, doing the job as well as you can do it.
But wait a minute, you described some of America's best and brightest coming in here. Surely they're thinkers as well. We know that we heard the dissent during different parts of the Iraq War before and after. Are they not thinking and talking about what's coming down?
No, they are thinking, but Tom, the rule is that you actually can't express, legally you can't express a political opinion on either side of the parties. So, and more,
well, I don't mean a political opinion, but maybe just an opinion about a particular deployment or about the strength of a force.
Oh, no, Tom, they'll talk about it, and they'll talk about whether they think it's a good idea or a bad idea privately. But they also know that when the time comes, they have to do it. And their leadership, what their job is to go be lieutenants, which is the most pure kind of leadership, which is you're going to take 34 guys hungry for leadership, guys or girls, right? And you're going to try to motivate them to do things that are very hard and often against their immediate physical interest. Mm-hmm. And they're going to draw on your enthusiasm. And so whatever you talk about in the officers' club, whatever you talk about back in barracks, when you step out there in front of those people, you have to be enthusiastic about the mission, whether it's dangerous, whether there's not enough force protection, because the best way to keep those people safe is to make them feel that you are fired up about what you're doing.
So they start as lieutenants, and you describe quite vividly how they're prepared to do that job, but of course they ascend all over the place and become top military leaders as well. You know, there's a debate about how widely the U.S. military ought to be deployed around the world these days. Surely military leaders will have some influence on that. Do you think they're ready to go out all over the place or more likely to lean toward restraint? Politics aside, just in terms of strategy.
You know, it was very funny when I first came up there. They were saying that how much harder it was to train for the world. This is before 9/11. How much harder it was to train for the post-Soviet world. Because you walk in there as a journalist and you think, hey, these guys have to be on one sort of, you know, 8-year party at this point because the pressure's off. We're not going to, you know, they'd always joked mm-hmm. about the people in Germany being the speed bump as the Warsaw Pact troops, stormed across
Europe. Came across, right?
Yeah, exactly. But actually, what some of the military P's, that's what you call a professor at West Point, what they said to me was it's much harder, although it's not because you don't know who your enemy is going to be, although it's not unforeseen, it's very much like the time after the Civil War when you didn't know exactly who you were going to be fighting, and you were fighting the Indians, you ended up fighting in the Philippines, then you ended up fighting in Cuba.
You're right, the military misses the old Soviet threat the way rich families miss the simple, pressing clarity of being poor.
Exactly. But the idea back then in the 1870s and also now is that since you can't train them for every situation because there's no way of knowing exactly what they'll be doing, if you train them to be the kind of people who can respond effectively to any situation, it almost doesn't matter where they're deployed. Now, one of the things I'd spoke about with some of the people from the Pentagon who were studying the cadets as they were training was that the cadets do come in with the notion that they're going to be what's called war fighters, and it's often very hard to motivate them
for peacekeeping or the mid-range humanitarian op. And what I've been hearing from cadets who deployed to Iraq is that now the combat's over, they're slightly bored. They're not really. It's much harder to keep your enthusiasm up when you're not. It's not kind of clear how long you're going to be there and what your mission really is.
Mm. And it's hot, and there's no clear end to your deployment, and people are being killed. David Lipsky, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation one of the very significant characters in your book, in this case not a cadet, but a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army who headed up military training at West Point from 1995 to 2000. He joins us tonight from Fort Montgomery, New York. Good evening and welcome, Hank Kersey.
Hello, Tom. It's good to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us, Colonel Kersey. You really get quite a depiction in David Lipsky's book as the very heart and soul of kind of gung-ho West Pointer spirit, the guy who was there to set the example for all these young cadets. You ended up having some trouble, in a way, growing out of that very gung-ho quality. But before we get to that, what's your sense of cadets today? Are they come out of a different culture than they did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, a different culture than when you got into the military? They've got a big global kind of job laid out before them. What's the spirit of the cadets coming out of West Point today?
Well, I can tell you that any mother or father would be very proud to have the kind of kids stand before them that they graduated from West Point. I saw just a few weeks ago, they just graduated the class of 2003, and it kind of brings a tear to your eye. These are the kids that are fully committed. They believe in the country. They believe that they are the centurions that will join the Legion somewhere on the frontier of freedom, and that the very freedom we enjoy today somehow will be defended by them and their troops out there. So it's a kind of noble thing to see these guys walk out there, and it's it's a powerful thing, and I can tell you that by and large, it is very uplifting to watch these kids come out and move forward and join the regiments that are now moving forward to Iraq.
And for years, you were the man at West Point who, after all the kind of culture gap crossing that David Lipsky describes, you were the one who got down and dirty in describing to them what their obligations would be in battle, in warfare. But we also read in David Lipsky's book, Absolutely American, about the so-called nice guy army, and we just heard David describing some of that, the more complex, subtle missions of peacekeeping. How do you train warriors to have both of these missions in mind, Hank Kersey, and is it a problem to create warriors and peacekeepers from the same group of young men and women?
Well, I think it's a lot harder, and an intelligent young man and one committed can, and with the intellect, can make some kind of a flexible choice when he gets out there. In fact, my son is right now with the 101st, and I just got an email from him today.
In Iraq?
In Iraq, and he is was in the initial raids that took down one of the cities there, some of the big compounds, and it's all very exciting to them. On Najaf, they were deployed out there. Mm-hmm. And then they got redeployed from there up to Mosul, and he became pretty much the viceroy of 100 square miles of barley fields. His mission was to ensure that the 45-55 split of harvest between the Kurds and the Arabs was actually actually happened that way, mm-hmm. that nobody got more than their share. So he ended up driving around and doing night assaults on harvesting machines and trying to see if they were properly registered. And he describes, how difficult that is to get his troops motivated to stay. They were, first of all, to get them motivated for the shooting part of the war. Mm-hmm. They'd all trained for that.
Right.
But then when you become the harvester of barley police,
right.
It became even more so, especially as the tour in country got hotter. And longer. And
it still gets hotter and longer. David Lipsky, you describe Hank Kersey as the longtime kind of embodiment of West Point spirit, what you call hua, if I pronounce that correctly. What is that spirit? And give us the Hank Kersey story, because it wasn't altogether easy at the end.
No, but I'd like to actually, and part of talking about Colonel Kersey would be talking about that word "hua." It's a great word to say, isn't it? It's kind of fun. Hua. It's what Pacino is saying in *Incredible Woman* when he wins an Oscar. He
hua.
Just keeps saying that word. So if you want to do a really easy Al Pacino impersonation, just say
"hua."
And everyone says, "Hey, Al Pacino."
What does it mean?
Well, it means it's an all-purpose military term. And for example, if you say, "Dave, your sound level's too high," right? I'll say "hua." It's a way of saying I understand. And if you say, you know, the engineer Chris came in and to get in to fix it, he had to go through a huge wall of fire, and there was a, you know, the wall was crumbling in. He had to brace it with one arm while he was actually using his fingers, his great grip as pliers to fix your microphone so the sound level would go back down. And I would say, man, that was an incredibly hua thing he pulled off.
So here was Colonel Kersey, the embodiment of that spirit. And then I'm reading and stunned to read as I go along that he ends up dismissed from the Army for fostering an environment antithetical to Army values. How can that be? It doesn't add up.
Well, it was the bravest thing I saw at West Point. And one of, you know, in our as a person in the world, as an adult in the world, one of the bravest things I've seen kind of ever. You know, there's a rule when you're a leader, real leadership is that you look after your people first. And Colonel Kersey's dad had also been a colonel with the U.S. Army, and he had taught Colonel Kersey, Hank, the fellow who is speaking to us now, the basic rule of leadership, which is that you are responsible for whatever your subordinates do or fail to do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the way I got to speak with Colonel Kersey at first was when I arrived at West Point as a Rolling Stone journalist, all dressed in my city black, and cadets started, you know, talking to me about their experiences. They said, look, they'd take me aside and they'd say, look, you know, I don't know who you're going to talk to here, and I don't know how long you're going to be here, but if you only talk to one person, cadet, officer, civilian, just talk to Colonel Kersey, because he's what this place stands for. He's what it's about. And then during my second year there, what I kind of think of as my sophomore year there, one of his subordinates made a joke that, an unfortunate political joke that didn't work in with one facet of what you were speaking of earlier and what the book speaks about. It's a quote from one of the cadets as the nice guy army.
Mm-hmm.
And he, because he didn't know how the computer system worked at West Point, he didn't realize that when he made the joke, it was a kind of a fake PowerPoint slide.
He talked about it as the wussy army.
Yeah, he was saying that not enough of the cadets were willing to join the combat branches and put it all on the line. This was in the fall of 99.
And the heat came down very, very hard for that. His career was on the line, and Hank Kersey took the
bullet. Remembered the lessons his father taught him, and he said, look, that man is my subordinate, and I'm responsible for him. And if you're going to take someone who's, you know, and at that point, the captain that we're talking about, you know, he had three babies, he had three kids, a young baby, and Colonel Kersey said, if someone's going to be punished for this, he reflects me, and I should be the one punished. Didn't have to do it. No one told him to do it.
But he did it. Colonel Hank Kersey, we've got to take a break, but I know we have to let you go. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Tom.
We're talking tonight about the inside story of West Point. Listeners, get into the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support for this. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the inside story of West Point and the education of America's Army. Elite, what lessons do you want drilled into America's West Point military leaders of the future? My guest tonight is David Lipsky, contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. He spent 4 years reporting on West Point. He's author of the new book, Absolutely American, 4 Years at West Point. You can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. David Lipsky, several things I want to ask you about. First of all, you describe West Point as an irony-free zone. We don't think of Rolling Stone as an irony-free zone. What do you mean by that exactly, and how does it play out?
Well, I mean that, you know, it's kind of, again, lingua franca in our world, I think, to demonstrate your strength of character by being above any particular set of values. That you might have one set of values subscribed to at a party and another set of values subscribed to at work.
But always wrapped in irony.
Yeah, exactly. And you might say it with a little bit of a twinkle in the eye, a little bit of a smile. One thing that I think is actually easier on people and great about the cadets at West Point is you just say what you believe, right? And it's better. And that surprised me because, you know, I'd always thought that it was better to make a joke of what I really felt
and that isn't the way they live, and I think they're better for it. Not that they're not funny, by the way. One of the great surprises about West Point was the reasons people find for going to the military. One of the main characters in the book is a kid named Whitey Herzog, who grew up as a deadhead. He ended up being the number 13th ranked military cadet in his class, so very successful as a cadet.
Out of 1,000+, it's a very
exactly.
High rank.
But the reason he went was that growing up as a deadhead, you know, music head, Allman Brothers fan, and his buddies, you know, would meet after school and sometimes even before after school and kind of go to the local park in Buffalo, Delaware Park, and drink out of paper bags. And he mm-hmm. wanted to protect their right to behave in such an unmilitary way. He thought that was one of the great things about America, that his friends could do that. And that's what he was and is fighting for. And that was amazing to me.
Without irony, women at the Academy, what year did they come and how is that now? We've heard a lot about the Air Force Academy in the last year and the sexual harassment there.
Sure.
How's West Point doing with its women?
Much better. They came into all the service academies at the same time, 76. It was a new, third century for America and a new dawn. So, and quite properly, they began letting women into the academies. West Point, I think, saw what the problems were in the first decade, which was rocky, and they made a very deliberate effort in the early 90s to change, to begin to re-educate some of the male cadets who were more resistant.
Men and women cannot be in the same room without the door open and cannot be in the same room on the same piece of furniture.
They cannot share the same piece of furniture, which is a way of saying they can't have sex in the barracks, because in my experience, to have a really successful sexual encounter, you have to share the same piece of furniture.
Typically.
Yeah. The best ones.
You write about women being given special training to heighten their violence propensity. you quote a professor saying that men will fight over a bar stool.
I knew you were going there. It's a great quote, isn't it?
It is a great quote. Yeah. Does it work? Do the men believe it? When the training is over, do they believe that the female officers-to-be standing beside them are as ready to fight as they are?
Well, Tom, I met a bunch of female cadets who were stronger than some of the male cadets. So, yeah, I think they do. I think also, you know, women aren't fully incorporated into the combat branches yet, and they may in fact never be. And they know, those women are hard. And again, even when I first got there in 98, there were a lot of guys, because one reason you join the Army is you want to do the things that guys do together, right? The kind of linked arms, marching against a foe sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But even during the 4 years that I was there with them, they realized it was great that women were there because the country is half women and it's nice to have women around. And then they realized, hey, beyond this resistance that we claim to have or that we have about women, the reality is these women are hard. They're meeting the standard. That's like one of the great West Point phrases. Did you meet the standard? You know, it's never clear what the standard is in the civilian world, but it's quite clear there. And it's nice that it's nice to be in their company. You know, it's civilizing and it's great. So that resistance kind of actually faded. So by 2001, 2002, a lot of the animosity I thought was gone from the place.
David Lipsky, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Leonard Wong. He's joining us from Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He's a retired lieutenant colonel, U.S. Army. He's now a professor at the Army War College, graduated West Point, class of 1980, and last month returned from Iraq, where he had been studying combat motivation. Good evening and welcome, Leonard Wong.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for joining us. David Lipsky is writing in great detail about West Point and how motivation and values are instilled there. You've just been looking at how they're acted out in the field. We heard earlier about the difficulties of maintaining post-combat from Hank Kersey in Iraq. How does the motivation look, and how would you define what motivates American Army soldiers today?
Well, you know, today's soldiers are they're not what we think they are. We have stereotypes in our mind about soldiers that we picked up from movies, mostly, I think. And I went to Iraq and I went to ask soldiers. I said, what kept you going in battle? What kept you going in combat? And what I found out is today's soldiers, they're smart. The average new soldier coming in 2002 had more than high school, so they have some college. They're savvy. They listen to the news. They listen to NPR. They watch the Internet. They know what's going on. But most importantly, they're volunteers. We just celebrated the 30th anniversary of the All-Volunteer Army, and they're not draftees anymore. And so they're not paid like their peers. You know, the food's not as bad as it used to be, but it's still not great. The living conditions are Spartan. Then what are they doing it for? Well, they're doing it because there's a deep underlying value that they saw that they were liberating the Iraqis. And that's where West Point comes in. Because if you read David's book, there's a theme going through it that says you take 18-year-olds and somehow they're transformed, not to just competent leaders, but leaders of character, leaders who understand values. And that's perfect for the type of soldiers that are leading today.
How do you think, I mean, a couple of thoughts come to mind. One was, during the war, we heard from a lot of reporters in the field that foot soldiers they talked to would say, would draw a line between their presence in Iraq and 9/11, saying, you know, we're here because of 9/11. Liberation was also part of it, but 9/11 was very big. That is, of course, not a universally accepted view of what Iraq was really all about. What do you make of that in this thinking military?
The thinking military I talked to, I asked them, why did they come in the Army in the first place? And hardly anyone came in for patriotic reasons. They came in for all the reasons that recruiters know, you know, for money for college, something to do, things like that. But then when you talk to them, okay, when the bullets were flying, what kept you going? Well, first, they fought for each other, just like the soldiers have always done. But then you heard this undercurrent saying, but when we saw the children, when we saw them standing on the sides of the street, we knew we were doing the right thing. We knew we were liberating the Iraqis. Now, they didn't say, we're looking for weapons of mass destruction. We're looking for regime change. They had an underlying fundamental value, and that's democracy that they were bringing to this country.
And you know, that can be a rocky road. No one knows yet if it's going to actually succeed. We've seen projects fail in the past. The U.S. military suffered for decades after Vietnam. How do you think the U.S. military will stand up there, Leonard Wong, if this is longer and tougher and less successful than it might have been hoped before the war was launched?
The soldiers definitely, you know, they want to get the war part over and then go home.
But the generals keep telling us the war's still on.
Right. But what's different about today's soldiers that hasn't been true in the past is that they're professionals. In other words, they're not the captain in Saving Private Ryan that's going to go back and teach fourth grade math or science teacher or English teacher. They joined the Army. This is their job. And so they understand that the nation is leaning on them. And they don't want to be there anymore, but they understand that the nation has handed them the burden of responsibility. They trust the Army now. They trust the leaders that David writes about. So now they're saying, okay, we're going to do it. It's uncomfortable, but we're professionals. We're not a draft Army anymore. And so now everything's led by trust. And so I'm very confident that, hey, okay, morale's going to go down, but they're still professionals.
Leonard Wong, thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Leonard Wong is a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, graduate of West Point class of 1980, and a professor at the Army War College. Don is calling from Boston. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm an active duty Army captain, and my concern that I've seen in my limited 4 years is that most of the West Pointers I've interacted with, and I'm not a West Point graduate.
Okay.
I'm sorry?
Where was your ROTC? Where'd you go to school?
Princeton.
Okay. And what's your concern, Don?
My concern is that most of the West Pointers with whom I've interacted tend to have a decidedly conservative bent that is out of sync with an America that is politically split.
A politically conservative bent. David Lipsky, is that the culture gap you're talking about? Is that part of it? Did you find them more conservative than the mainstream? And Don, hang on.
The Army is always going to be more Republican than – I mean, again, they're not legally – as Don knows, not legally allowed to have a political opinion that you state. But they tend to be more Republican in their sympathies because they feel confident that somehow Republicans will put more money aside for military spending. But, I mean, they're Nader voters. Some of my best friends up there were guys who had voted for Nader.
We heard a couple of years ago – I forget the name of the book now, but there was a book out which basically made the case that, yes, the military is a culture apart. And it's conservative culture, kind of along the lines of what Don is saying.
Stephanie Gutman's book, sure. That was Stephanie Gutman's book, The Kinder, Gentler Military.
Mm-hmm.
The notions of the conservative notions that may not be ones that I would vote for example, are ones that kind of dovetail really, really well with the military, which is that essentially kind of restraint, right? I mean, if the Democrats, aside from all the good things they do socially, are the party of a certain kind of freedom, it's always going to appeal less to someone who really is thinking in a military way than the Republican Party.
So, Don, what is your concern about the impact of that? It's kind of perhaps intuitively expected that military men and women might be more politically conservative, but what impact do you fear there?
I fear that the soldiers that are coming into the Army are from all social stratums. And yet, most of the officers from West Point come out with a distinctly conservative ideology that I don't think is necessarily reflective of the soldiers that they're leading. Particularly, I find my political sympathies frequently overlap with minority soldiers whereas a lot of times other officers just aren't seeing it. You know, Clinton was a dirty word. Being a Democrat is still something that is frowned upon within the officers I've associated with. One more point. You know, I understand that Republicans tend to support Democratic or military spending more, but I'm a junior officer, and most people with whom I've had contact are junior officers, and we're not looking at big picture who's providing more money for military spending.
No, Don, that's an irony, isn't it? But I'd be curious about something you said about the racial things. I couldn't think of a place that was more racially cool, for want of a better word, than the military. It's one of the things that was kind of real surprising to me there.
No, and I would agree with you. I think the opportunities are just really amazing, and I've met some and worked for some incredible people that have just really, they're just impressive individuals. But at the same time, there's a disconnect between the West Pointers that I've met that have just been just really conservative and soldiers in general.
Don, thanks for your call. It brings up another point I wanted to ask you, David Lipsky. You write a lot about the culture of service at West Point. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you make much in the book, and so do the officers you quote there, of the problem of retention, that lots of West Pointers get in, and, of course, they're obligated then to give 5 years of service to the Army, but the five-and-fly dynamic is very powerful, and it's not really a lifetime of service. It's as few years as they can devote. You describe a ranking officer going back for his 10th anniversary or reunion of West Point graduation and finding only 25% of his fellow reunion alums were still in uniform.
That's quite right, Tom. Look, the best ones stay in. I mean, it's a hard thing. It's how do you, the whole culture is based around, you know, what can you get for yourself, right? And this kind of service.
The whole American culture or West Point culture or both?
No, the whole American culture and the Army culture and West Point culture is one of the last places in this country where people will say that they're not doing it for the money. And the ones who stay, the ones who give 10, 20, 30 years to this job are really the ones who are doing this for love of the work and love of the nation they live in. Now, it's harder to find people like that because, you know, we're all so fallen, right? But when the people who stay are people who are expressing something that's quite different, and I think a lot of people know in their gut is a little bit better.
David Lipsky, it's a beautifully written book, and I have to say I learned a lot from the intimate observation that you were able to do over those 4 years. We thank you for writing it, and thank you for joining us tonight.
Oh, no, Tom, it was a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
David Lipsky is author of Absolutely American, 4 Years at West Point. Jack, I'm still trying to sort through all this. It's a culture apart, and yet people want out of it and into a higher-paying corporate culture as soon as they can.
It's hard to blame them for that, and they've certainly had a good training in the technical branches. But, you know, to bring up a question raised by Don, our captain, we had two military sociologists on our program not too long ago who were talking about just this, how much more Republican the officer corps has become in the last 30 years, strikingly so. And another guest who spoke of the formation in America of a warrior caste. Something to worry about in a volunteer army, especially where father follows son, as our Colonel Kersey put it, the centurions joining the legion. That's not exactly democratic talk, and I don't take anything away from the colonel.
Jack, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks.